Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com. Sci-fi, horror, and other genre flicks are doing their best to scare the stiffs at Fantastic Fest. Read all about them at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. It's Cops Gone Wild Week here on Film Spotting. We'll review Lakeview Terrace and Righteous Kill, starring Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Reunited, but does it feel so good? We'll find out. Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Scotland Yard Gospel Choir, and in honor of Righteous Kill's Holy Acting Union, we'll share the top five actor pairings we'd like to see.
But first, we go in the company of men. Namely, Samuel L. Jackson and Neil LaBute.
New neighbors, huh?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Did you meet them yet?
You want to give people a chance to settle in, you know?
I always wanted to say this. We're homeowners.
Give up the wallet, man. Give it up!
Welcome to the neighborhood.
What? Never roll your window down when somebody does.
Scared the hell out of me.
Imagine that.
Maddie, during your setup for our discussion of Burn After Reading on last week's show, you quoted Tilda Swinton describing all of the characters in that movie as monsters. And somewhere, Neil LaBute, the playwright-turned-director who unleashed upon the world narcissistic demons such as In the Company of Men's Chad, Carrie from Your Friends and Neighbors, and Evelyn from The Shape of Things, must have laughed, or maybe smirked. I don't know. Either way, monsters have always kind of been Neil LaBute's corner of the dramatic market. In Lakeview Terrace, LaBute's first movie since Nurse Betty that he didn't also write, our monster is Abel Turner, an L.A. cop, widower, and father of two, who doesn't exactly roll out the welcome mat for the mixed-race couple who just moved into their starter home next door, played by Patrick Wilson and Kerry Washington. You probably remember Patrick Wilson as Kate Winslet's hunky pool partner from Little Children, and I hope you'll remember Kerry Washington from The Last King of Scotland or even Ray, and not as the party girl seductress from Chris Rock's I Think I Love My Wife. So, Maddie, I'm tempted to pose to you the same question you posed to me last week. Do we care about the fate of this monster or this monster's self-absorbed victims? But what I'm most curious to hear is whether you think LaBute is saying anything of substance with Lakeview Terrace. Are we getting any real insight into race relations in this country, or is this just a glossy, well-acted, trashy thriller?
Well, I can only speak for myself, but this film definitely changed my immediate purview. I don't know if it's going to have any lasting effect, but I do remember commenting to you upon exiting the theater that, man, that theater was 70% black. Mm-hmm. And then taking the Red Line train home, collecting my thoughts about this film, I couldn't help but notice the absolutely beautiful African-American woman sitting across from me in the train car, and also noticing the fact that the train car was, in fact, 80% black. Now, I don't want people sitting at home to go, the white guy noticed that there are people who are different than him. Isn't that special?
Congratulations,
Maddie. Let's share a Coke. No, I know how silly I may sound, but I've got to give credit to this film for altering my perspective, even in the slightest, because ultimately, most films, you can't say that about them.
That's true.
Now, does the entire film work? No, it doesn't. But my general feelings usually about LaBute's work is that he's usually the first, but rarely the best. His work is driven by tackling those hot button issues, subverting them, putting a spin on them in some way, and then presenting them in really volatile, really incendiary ways. Now, if I were to make a list of which directors would be the first to try to answer the question, what if the black cop was racist? Neil LaBute, of course, would be the first director that would come to mind. But his works for me always seem rather ethereal, rather fleeting, as though they'll serve as a good rough draft on the subject, but won't stand the test of time as true, social commentary. And not to compare playwrights, but to compare playwrights, the reason I believe David Mamet's Oleanna is an extremely successful commentary on sexual harassment is because it's never a play about sexual harassment. The term isn't even uttered in the film or the movie. Here in Lakeview Terrace, everyone has an opinion
about
exactly whether the white guy should be with the black girl, the dad, the neighbor. You know, this film is not an exercise in subtlety, but with some exceptions, I found this treatment thoroughly thoroughly entertaining. Mm-hmm. I think this film, it gets away from him at the end. It gets a little silly at the end.
It does.
But for the most part, the tension is menacing and hilarious at times and sleazy fun at times. But you know exactly where this film is going. But I have to say, Adam, I was definitely, definitely entertained.
I'm right there with you, Maddie. I did find this movie very entertaining and provocative enough, certainly, to recommend it. And I don't know if it's saying anything of real substance or not, to be totally honest, but I really did feel like the characters and their interactions, Kerry Washington, Patrick Wilson as the couple, I felt like they were all genuine and that the screenwriters and Neil LaBute weren't doing anything to sensationalize. They weren't just pushing on those hot button issues and trying to make us squirm in our seats. There is a little bit of that. We do feel uncomfortable, but again, I didn't feel like it was sensationalized. And I felt like something different here from LaBute's other work that I'm familiar with. I'm not as familiar on the drama side, the theatrical side, but he doesn't give us the distance from the characters here that we get with some of his other movies, where we can sit back and watch those monsters on screen and feel good about the fact that, hey, I'm pretty self-absorbed, but at least I'm not as self-absorbed mm-hmm. as that guy is, and at least I'm not as solipsistic as those people, and I'm not as messed up as that guy. Here we actually have to ask ourselves how we would react in these various difficult situations, and there are no simple answers, and I think that it's a credit to LaBute and the screenwriters, David Lowery and Howard Korter, that they don't try to provide any of those answers. And beyond the race stuff that does come up in this film, which obviously, as you said, it's a huge aspect of this movie. It's the biggest theme they're tackling here. But I was really intrigued by some of the other themes that they explore here, including masculinity. And I want to play a clip here. I believe this is a scene where Patrick Wilson, Chris is his name, and Abel, Samuel L. Jackson, they've already had a few bad encounters where Chris has tried to get him to shut his lights off and do a few things, and basically Abel has said, you know, I'm not interested. He's not going to do that. Here he's come over to their party, I think, a little housewarming party, and it's gone very badly, and this is their confrontation right after that.
Abel, hold on. Look.
And whatever it is about me or us that bothers you, we got to figure out a way to deal with this, all right?
So what do you propose?
What?
What's your agenda?
Can we all just get along?
Oh, not Rodney King. You playing the race card?
Come on, man. This is getting a little out of hand. I need you to back off.
Back off?
Yeah, a little.
Or what?
I think that scene right there is great, the back off scene, because it's a case where what happens when Patrick Wilson, who's this very well-meaning, liberal, smart guy, says to Samuel L. Jackson, you know, we need to figure out this situation mm-hmm. so we can all live in harmony together. And Samuel L. Jackson says, okay, what do you have in mind?
Patrick Wilson has a career in front of him as playing that sort of banal, suburban house.
He's good at it.
Husband. No, he's great. He's great here. And so is Kerry Washington, who plays his wife. I mean, she's a little pixie-ish, yeah. A little hard to take sometimes. But you're absolutely right. This play never skimps on substance. It never, ever talks down to you. And you're right. You talked about theme. Theme always has to come second. It always has to evolve from plot. And the fact of the matter is the plot basically is Samuel L. Jackson. He's this cop. His wife has died. He's raising these two children. We really should applaud his efforts. He's actually...
And we do at times.
Yeah, he's raising a great home. But then, of course, there's that flip side. There's this flip side that, of course, he can't quite register what's going on when his neighbors are, you know, suffering from jungle fever, as it were.
Yeah.
There are a couple times where it's a little bit overwritten, just
sure.
A little bit spoon-fed. There actually is an occurrence of the line, I don't even recognize you
there
anymore.
Is. I squirmed at that line,
Oh, man,
line
I had
too.
To squirm.
It's bad.
And I think it labors to crawl across the finish line. When the kids predictably leave to go to their aunties for 2 weeks,
sure.
Well, that's basically
setting
the film
up.
Setting you up, saying, look, the confrontation's coming. Well, it takes about a half hour for that confrontation to finally
True.
Get there. But for me, what made this movie was Samuel L. Jackson.
He's
he
great.
He is transcendent here. You loved him last year in
Black Snake Moan. Yeah.
I think he's even better here. He is genuinely, genuinely scary. And really, Sam Jackson at the top of this game is as good as anyone. And he fully embodies that character, and it's worth seeing just for that alone. And you're right, it is funny at times. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there are these long takes on him where he's just sort of glowering menacingly, and,
yeah.
and the theater ate it up.
They
Again,
did.
A largely African-American audience laughing and clapping along with it. It is a fun movie
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah, you're right. There is some humor there, which is great, but those confrontations really do set up the story here and allow you to get into some of the substance. And, you know, I played that scene where you have that confrontation because it shows you have really flawed characters here. You've got male characters feeling the need to constantly show that they're a man. And what's great is LeBute doesn't go over the top with it here. It's not about these men trying to be the baddest guy on the street or be a tough guy. They're just doing what they think they have to do as a man.
Playing
to
that
be
role,
a husband.
Fulfilling
they're
that
fulfilling
role.
Their obligation. He's constantly, Patrick Wilson is constantly telling his wife, no, let me go take care of this. I'm supposed to go do this. And so that fascinated me just as much as the race discussion did here, and also the whole idea of how you don't really have any privacy anymore. Everything can be seen. All these houses build on top of each other. Everybody knows what everyone else is doing right next door. I thought that was interesting. And yeah, by the end of the film, he sets up this, I don't know, metaphor is not the right word. It's right there in your face, but we have the fires, raging
are coming,
in California, and they're literally coming. Of course, we're going to get the big fire explosion at the end of the movie just as the fires are coming in on this family
but
in this neighborhood. It's a little too much.
But don't be afraid of melodrama, though.
No.
When did we ever get afraid of melodrama? If you do it right and you can pull it off, and I get it. I get it. I mean, it's not smacking you over the face here.
It's not?
No, I don't think.
I think it's a little heavy.
I think it's done well enough. For me, it was the characters going off and sort of talking about the black-white issues that we didn't quite need. Those could have been pared down. A good 15 minutes could have been pared down.
Those could have been pared down. But I will give the movie credit for giving us one of the best bits in movies all year long, and that is early in the film when Samuel L. Jackson is watching out his window, seeing the new family move in next door, and you've got this very well-dressed man, older man, with a younger African-American woman. It's Kerry Washington, turns out, with her father, and Patrick Wilson is her husband, but he's wearing a white t-shirt and jeans, and he's unloading the moving van.
He's
and
the
Samuel
moving
L. Jackson
guy.
Says, yeah, it's the mover. I'll go over and say hi after the mover leaves.
And of course,
that's a great bit of reverse.
Note who he's talking to. He's talking to an Asian-American. Of course, none of this is done by accident.
No, but I love that bit because, of course, how many times have we seen in movies where there's that assumption made that, oh, that's the black character, so they must be the valet or something, right? And here it's the African-American character saying, oh, he's the mover. I really did think that was pretty funny. I got to close, though, Maddie, by asking you about one potential flaw. And we've talked about a few other flaws, but I think maybe the big one is that the movie does labor to explain Samuel L. Jackson's behavior, why he is so worked up about this mixed-race couple next door. We actually get a scene where it gives us the context for his rage about this couple, and I wonder if we need it. Did something have to happen for him to be bothered by this white and black couple next door? Maybe in this day and age, yes, where we expect that everyone's so open-minded, but don't we all understand human nature enough and understand that his attitudes might be such that, you know, a guy like Abel has grown up and has had to contend with a lot of things in his life and has seen a lot of racism, that he might have his own racist point of view. Can't we just accept that as human nature, this kind of fear of the other, as opposed to and wanting to stick together, as opposed to needing some melodramatic explanation for it?
No, you can't do that, actually, because he needs that motivation. LeBute is so smart here. He sets him up as an all-world father at the beginning. We want to cheer for him. So we can't just go along and say, and again, he's a policeman. He's a policeman that is there to protect humanity, no matter their skin, no matter their creed, no matter their religion. So what we need is a reason for him to flip.
He needs that extra motivation.
He absolutely needs it, and LeBute is a player. Right. And of course, you know, his name's not on the screenplay, but he realizes that Jackson needs that flip. He absolutely needs that to propel the final act of the script. Otherwise, you don't have it. Otherwise, it doesn't fulfill a complete, and here I go again, Aristotelian arc.
Okay. Well, I'm open for discussion on that. Like I said, I really am posing the question. My immediate reaction is I'm not sure I needed it. I thought it was more interesting to just accept that he has that basic inherent kind of human fear. We didn't need the melodramatic explanation. But again, I'm open to discussion on it. Lakeview Terrace hopefully will provoke some interesting discussions. And if not, it's just an entertaining movie. It's out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and a discussion of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino in Michael Mann's Heat. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. John Abnett's Righteous Kill. I was far away from Masaccio and frescoes in the Brancacci Chapel. I was thinking about you, boy. Ungodly thoughts, I know, but I'm not ashamed. I was dreaming I was filming a picture with you on an island there. Somewhere off the mainland, we were alone, we were getting some practice in. I'm Sandro Botticelli, I'm torn between the old and new, between the way I've
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I'm Chuck.
So I gathered.
You are.
Here you are, Chuck.
At least give me a made-up name, something from you. Cry out during those dark nights of the soul.
Cry out, Olivia.
That's 12th night.
Very good, Chuck. Pleasantly surprised. You're not like the other murderers.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I perform a scene, that's the massacre, from a beloved screenplay, that's the theater, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard between Samuel Rockwell and Julia Roberts from Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, a tie-in, of course, with last week's review of Burn After Reading.
Yes, George Clooney, of course, and Brad Pitt, both stars of Burn After Reading. They are also in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. George Clooney directed Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, his debut as a director. There's the espionage tie-in there. And Sam Rockwell is in the movie Choke, coming out this fall, which we'll hear about in listener feedback. Some of our listeners are very much looking forward to that film.
All right, well, why don't you reach your hand into that Film Spotting hat and pull out this week's winner. And I have to add, you know, it's funny what films bring out different entries every week. Really, we saw names we had never seen before. I mean, this film is really loved by a unique niche of people.
It absolutely is. We heard from a lot of new listeners this week, as you said, and the winner is Sean T. DeLapp, speaking of listeners I don't recognize, Maddie, from Lodi, California.
Lodi?
Yeah, Lodi. Good Creedence tune there.
I'm going to put it out by Chino.
Yeah, you don't know. You put everything out by Chino, but a good Creedence tune there. Of course, Sean is stuck in Lodi. Congratulations to Sean. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and we're not going to give any hint here. It does tie in with something we're discussing on this week's show. That's all we're going to say. Maddie, you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Don't you try to catch me!
Not me, no. You're the one who wants to get yourself killed, not me. It always happens with you guys, you know? The last minute you always want to grab onto something, take somebody with you. Down you go, not me, brother.
Aren't you going to try to grab me?
Friend of mine was up about 20 floors with a jumper a few years ago. Jumper grabbed him, they went off, 20 floors down, just mashed them all over the place. Couldn't tell which legs went with which arms with which, and it was a terrible mess. I tell you, I almost threw up myself. I just like your name and address, that's all.
Why?
Well, like I said, it's such a mess down there afterwards. Makes identification impossible. Even if they find your driver's license, all that blood and everything.
I think I'm going to puke.
Don't do that, son. I mean, all those people down there looking up, fire chief looking up his face.
You rotten bastard.
And see, I wanted to do that part, Maddie. That's the best part we've ever had in Massacre Theater, I think, right there. If you know what film we just massacred, send us an email with your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, September 24th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at filmspotting.net.
I've been a cop in the NYPD for over 30 years.
Why'd you become a cop?
Where I come from, it was either a gun and a badge or a hard hat and a hammer.
Between the eyes.
You like carrying a gun?
There's nothing wrong with a little shooting as long as the right people get shot.
What about the badge?
The badge is nice, as long as it comes with a gun.
I am forced to dismiss all charges of rape and assault.
When you walk outside, watch your back.
Order in my court.
Okay, watch your back.
Order!
That's right. You keep smiling.
You just heard a trailer from the latest crime drama, Righteous Kill. Adam, you know, sometimes we really are the envy of our peers. I know it's hard to imagine, but we oftentimes people will come up, fellow critics, and say, we really, really envy you because we're not beholden to see every film,
right,
especially every big film that comes down the pike. And I think it's pretty safe to say that any other week we probably would not be reviewing Righteous Kill. But actually, I am glad we're reviewing Righteous Kill this week because we're usually very director-centric.
True.
On this show. Well, we're certainly not reviewing Righteous Kill because John Avnet is behind the camera. No offense to Mr. Avnet, whose directorial debut, it needs to be said, was a successful little film called Fried Green Tomatoes
yes.
in 1991. But rather, we're discussing this film because Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are in front of the camera. They're playing well-worn characters, longtime partners, detectives. They're grizzled. They've been through the wars. And they have to decipher who is behind a string of murders, victims known pretty well to both policemen. The list of suspects and red herrings is long. But at the end of the day, I have to say the story is nothing unusual. What people really want to know, Mr. Campanar, is this movie worth seeing because Mr. De Niro and Mr. Pacino are working their magic together?
Unfortunately, not, Maddie. I wish I could say it was. This film is basically one big gimmick that is not interesting in any way, shape, or form. And the one saving grace, you're right, was supposed to be that at least we'd get to watch these two legends square off together. Again, they were both in The Godfather 2, but never on screen together. They're in Heat, but they're on screen together for one scene, even though I do think it's a great scene. Here, they're in lots of scenes together, and unfortunately, John Avnet's camera work and the editing is distracting. The dialogue here from Russell Jewerts, who wrote Inside Man, a great screenplay and a great film.
Oh, it's so tepid. It's so forgettable.
The dialogue is so bad that, you know what, this could be De Niro and Pacino circa 1975, circa Deer Hunter and Dog Day Afternoon, and Maddie, it would still be unwatchable.
Yeah, at the very least, I wanted to be able to walk away from this film with some quotable lines that I could yell at you for the next 3 months, but we're not even given that.
No.
I mean, ultimately, if you like crime dramas, if you like mysteries, I'm not going to dissuade you from seeing this film.
I am.
It really?
Yes.
I think it's passable.
It's so terrible.
I think it's passable. It's like one of those mindless novels you see on the rack at the airport bookstore. I mean, it's fine for an hour and a half. It's just completely dumb. In fact, though, I did write a bonus edition of Massacre Theater.
Do I have
for this?
I'm going to
give you the script. I'm going to give you the
nice.
Script here. Just 1 second.
Please.
Okay, you are. Now imagine we're 3 years in the future. My wife, a former Miss Argentina, and I were sitting on the couch, and she's flipping through the channels. Adams, of course, you're playing my wife.
I am playing the woman,
and
as always.
You give me the action. This encapsulates my review of this film.
Love it. Here we go. And action.
Whoa. Wait a second. Wait, stop it.
What?
Well, no, I know that movie. What is that movie? Oh man!
Isn't that Mr. Fokker?
No, wait, no, don't flip to the guide. Let me guess.
What's with that guy's hair?
That's Al Pacino. This is the one with De Niro and Pacino. What was the name of that thing?
Should we watch it?
Oh Lord, no! It turns out that the blankety blank did it.
Okay, did I ever tell you how extraordinarily handsome and gifted as a lover you are?
And scene.
I can't believe you made me just say that.
Very
Maddie.
Nicely delivered. Hands down, it's completely forgettable, but if it's on TBS late at night, I mean, you could get sucked into it.
I don't think you could
here. Really?
I mean, really, no, it's just terrible. The serial killer motive, the impetus for the spree is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's a bad Seven knockoff anyway. A much better film, of course, from David Fincher. There's shades of it here. But the only thing I will give this movie credit for is the most unintentionally hilarious credit sequence in the history of cinema.
You stayed for the credits?
No, the opening credits, Maddie. The opening credits of this film, do you remember how they go?
No.
You've got credits. You've got loud, thumping, fast rock music, and Pacino and De Niro standing in a dark target range shooting their guns. So just think kind of MTV-style fast editing, their guns, you know, the crackle, the pop of the guns with the credits firing up on the screen. there's no target range in the world that looks like this. It's sort of a metaphor for the entire film, right? It's dark, it's empty, and it's silly. And they're shooting these guns, and then we actually get a cut to, and this is still the credit sequence, a cut to Pacino and De Niro pumping iron. Yeah. They're lifting weights. They're actually like bench pressing together. It's a montage. Bench pressing and firing range. And then they go back to the firing range, and this time they've put aside their sidearms, and they break out machine guns. They're shooting machine guns, and it's so bad, and it actually ends with Pacino turning to De Niro and laughing, that I thought to myself, maybe John Avnet has enough of a sense of humor that he's setting up how ridiculous this whole movie's going to be. He's being ironic. Sadly, I watched the rest of the film. I don't think he is being ironic. I think he's trying to be cool.
For the first time on this show ever, you have convinced me. Don't watch this film. You're right.
Just the opening credits?
That was absolutely ridiculous. I completely forgot about that.
They're pumping iron. Partners who pump iron together.
I do think one thing. I think this movie does settle once and for all who's the better actor right now.
You think so?
I think so. I think hands down, you have to go with De Niro. And the reason is, and here's my reason. I'd rather see Al Pacino's Lear on stage. But in terms of on screen, De Niro is better because at least he is one of those actors that doesn't mind playing second fiddle,
mm-hmm.
and he understands the strength of subtlety. Now, can you imagine Mr. Pacino in roles like the ones De Niro played in Jackie Brown, Flawless, Wag the Dog,
no.
or any of those films?
No, you're
no,
right.
He's too big.
And he is.
And ultimately, I have to say, sorry to go off on a tangent, but I think it's actually more fun than discussing this film. If you look back at their entire body of work, I don't really think it's a contest.
No.
I think it's De Niro.
Yeah,
I got to give it to De Niro.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at their best films
right.
against each other, it's very close.
So
they're
exactly.
all Pantheon
De Niro,
films.
De Niro's best role, though. Go. De Niro's best role.
Jake LaMotta, Raging Bull.
Travis Bickle. Jimmy
yeah.
Conway. Rupert Pupkin. The Deer Hunter's Michael. You can
right.
go down the list. Now go Al Pacino.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Serpico. Michael Corleone.
All right, so we got 72.
Ricky Roma.
We got 72 to 75 for Pacino. He was actually ahead.
Maybe so, yeah.
And then, of course, he took some time off in the 80s.
Yes.
And he came back as Al Pacino. Unfortunately, and there, you know, Ricky Roma is fun. I like Big Boy Caprice is fun. But then he starts to hoo-ha. And he's been hoo-haing for about the last 12 years.
I know.
Has Bobby De Niro ever had to hoo-ha for a role?
No, he never has. And you're right. That's why he is the better actor over his career. He has a better track record, and that's why he's still more fun to watch on screen. He is much better than Pacino here. But even I was hoping for some more unintentional humor, possibly,
right.
than we got. I was hoping to really revel in how bad they were and how over-the-top Pacino
well,
is.
Well,
he's not
no,
that big.
In fact, they gave Pacino the humorous lines.
Like, they
did. He's supposed to be the funny guy, and A, he dropped the ball, and B, the lines were just terrible.
They are really bad. This movie, unfortunately, is a flop. I don't know why these guys would choose this script to finally team up again on screen. It's really mind-boggling. The last thing I do want to say about it, for those out there who are maybe of the type who don't like sexism in movies, maybe are very sensitive to misogyny, I'm just going to say right now, if maybe you're writing a term paper on the subject in cinema or something, watch this movie, because poor Carla Gugino, if mm-hmm. I'm saying her last name right, she may have one of the worst roles for a woman in the history of film. I really felt
sorry
for her.
Wait a second. Are you saying this is more misogynistic than her role in that awful Frank Miller Sin City thing?
It's close.
Wow.
It's actually close, because at least that movie sets itself up as a tawdry graphic novel, and you know everyone's in that world. Here, I don't know. The movie wants to be moralistic and high-minded a little bit, even though it's still kind of trashy. It wants to be moralistic, and then we get her, and I felt so sorry for her throughout this entire film. It's really bad. Unfortunately, Righteous Kill, we cannot recommend that you see, but it's out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback@filmspotting.net. Somebody tell us that Pacino is actually better than De Niro. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Hey guys, I won't say I'm disappointed in you. I just feel sorry for you. Another ego-boosting edition of Listener Feedback is next. Stay with us.
Here's one of me. Just 15. I'm smiling.
Hey guys, Kevin Beist here from Spout.com. I co-host Film Couch, Spout's weekly podcast. This week on Spout Blog, we've been catching up on our backlog of Toronto coverage. Be sure to check out our Coen Brothers interview, our interview with Anne Hathaway from the new film Rachel Getting Married, our interview with Michael Cera from Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, and our interview with the one and only Danny Boyle.
I have a drinking problem. You're a Mormon. Next to you, everybody has a drinking problem. Adam and Maddie, this is Ken from Birmingham. I just wanted to call and let you know. I saw Burn After Reading yesterday. I just listened to your review. I wanted to wait until after I'd seen it to listen. And maybe it was a little harsh of y'all. Maybe you were expecting having higher expectations coming off of No Country for Old Men.
Hello, Adam and Maddie. This is Josh from Coral Springs, Florida. And I have to say that I disagree with you guys incredibly on Burn After Reading, which I thought was a great, zany, hilarious addition to the Coen Brothers comedy canon. It certainly lacks any of the thematic resonance of a No Country for Old Men or even a Fargo, but I thought that all these actors and Ethan and Coen in the writing were just having an incredible amount of fun, and a lot of the reactions and lines just, for me, worked very well.
Hey guys, it's Eve calling from Brooklyn, New York. My most anticipated fall film has been, since last year, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Ever since I saw the still photograph of the weird sort of aged baby Brad Pitt, I have been counting down the days till Christmas. Cate Blanchett, David Finchner, I know your feelings are mixed on Mr. Pitt sometimes, but I think this is the one to see.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and definitely the theme of the week in feedback here. You heard it in the voicemails. You're going to hear it some more in the mailbag. We were wrong about Burn After Reading last week when we discussed the new Coen Brothers movie. We didn't think it was very funny, but there are a lot of Coen Brothers apologists out there, apparently, in Film Spotting land. We heard from many of them, as we did there, Ken and Josh. And also Eve chiming in with her number one most anticipated movie of the fall, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I believe it was number three on my list last week, the new David Fincher film. We're going to get to some more of your thoughts in the mailbag here on fall movies and the Coen Brothers in a minute. But first, we want to share the results of our poll question last week. And we asked you what your most anticipated fall movie is. Here were your choices: The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Milk, of course the Gus Van Sant movie with Sean Penn, Miracle at St. Anna, the new one from Spike Lee, The Road, based on the Cormac McCarthy novel, W, the new movie from Oliver Stone, Zack and Miri Make a Porno from Kevin Smith, or Other. Maddie, how did it come out?
Number one, agree with Eve from Brooklyn, 30%, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. A lot of love for David Fincher,
yes.
And of course, Mr. Pitt.
That too.
Close second, Zack and Miri Make a Porno at 20%. I'm glad to see that up there. The Road, 16% in third place. Other in fourth place at 11%. And, you know, there are a lot of great films
Definitely.
Coming out. Milk at 10%. I'm really looking forward to that one. W, 8%. Miracle at St. Anna.
In last
the new
place.
Spike Lee joint. 5%. The man cannot earn any respect.
I guess not, though he was number one on your list last week,
mm-hmm.
I believe. Miracle at St. Anna was. And, of course, The Road, which finished in third place there. That was my number one. Spike Lee's going to get some love, though, next week on the show. So we're going to do our top five Spike Lee scenes in conjunction with our review of that new film. This week's poll question goes back to our review in the last segment of Righteous Kill, the new movie starring Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And we want to know, which legendary actor you think is better these days?
Is it Bobby De Niro? Is it Al Pacino? Is it Barking Dogs?
Would you rather watch Barking Dogs on screen than either of those guys? Let us know. You can make your voice heard. Vote in the poll at filmspotting.net. Before we get into the mailbag here, I did want to share a couple of quick notes. And Maddie, the first one is the story from Toronto. I have to bring this up. Involving Roger Ebert. Did you hear about the fracas at Toronto?
I love Ebert. I absolutely love this man. You need to go to his website to read his journals. He's keeping sort of an online blog of everything. It's just a delight to read about.
Apparently, if you haven't heard this already, apparently he was at a screening. Was it Slumdog Millionaire, the new Danny Boyle film that was a big hit at Toronto. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to see it, but everybody was raving about it. And he was at a screening of that, and he was sitting behind the New York Post film critic Lou Luminek. And, of course, Ebert can't talk. So he's trying to get Lou's attention and tapping him on the shoulder to see if he can maybe adjust in his seat a little bit so Ebert can see the screen better. And Lou never wants to turn around. And finally, he gets so fed up of being tapped on the shoulder that he stands up, yells at Ebert, not knowing it's Roger Ebert, yells at him, and then hits him with his notebook. He actually accosts him with
his
notebook.
On his knee.
Oh, it was just his knee?
Yes.
Well, according to reports, everyone in the theater heard it. It was loud enough that everyone heard it, caused this big stir. And from what I've read, he knew it was Ebert. Later, he realized it was Ebert, but still at this point hasn't apologized. I mean, as if it's not bad enough having to read the New York Post movie reviews, now you have to worry about them hitting you during screening.
Take that, Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, too funny. It's really good that Roger Ebert can have a sense of humor about those kind of things. And the other note, we want to share just a quick email from a listener, because a few weeks ago on the show, Maddie, we threw out there the idea of the film spotting bricks. We were looking for a name for movies where they're kind of little films that we get behind and really champion, and maybe listeners wouldn't have heard about them or seen them otherwise if we hadn't talked about them. And Brick, of course, referencing the Rian Johnson film that we talked about a lot here on the show a few years ago. We got this one from Kabir in Chicago, who we actually had a chance to meet up with at the Chicago meetup a few weeks ago.
Very, very nice guy. He writes in, I just saw the movie The Pool the other day and remembered from a few years ago that you guys talked and raved about this small film from Chris Smith. I have to thank you, as I would have never heard of it, let alone have seen it. It's pure cinema, a simple story, beautifully told. It's so refreshing to see an American filmmaker working in a foreign land and telling a great story that doesn't rely on melodrama the way that a lot of independent films tend to do. I loved every second of it. It's one of my favorite films of the year. Thank you, and keep up the great work, guys.
Yeah, The Pool is a movie you haven't actually had a chance to see yet, Maddie, though it is now playing here in Chicago. It's at the Landmark, I'm sure, in other select cities around the country. And Sam and I reviewed it back at 2007 Sundance. It's just now getting a release. Chris Smith, of course, the filmmaker also behind American Movie, a documentary I like a whole lot. But it's a really interesting film to check out. And Kabir writing in with one of those movies that could be one of those film-spotting bricks. I have to say, though, all these suggestions coming into the mailbag, here's what you should call it, I thought they were pretty pedestrian. Most of our listeners were throwing out things like film spotted or in the spotlight. I kind of like film spotting brick. I think we should just give it the brick.
I think we might have to go with that. I mean, ultimately, what's it going to end up being? It's probably just going to end up being an icon on the website
exactly,
next to the name of the film. But I think people understand the intention of what we're trying to do.
Hopefully.
We're not trying to build ourselves up as though like we were the ultimate authorities on film.
No.
I do love that reaction. Hey, you guys, where do you guys get off telling us what we should go see?
Oh, I missed those emails.
Oh, yeah, there were a couple of those. I love those. Hey, you guys shouldn't tell me what I need to see.
Okay.
I listen to everybody else.
Don't listen to the show then,
fine.
I guess.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and get in to the mailbag and those reactions to the new Coen Brothers film, Burn After Reading.
What you're engaged in is blackmail. That is a felony. That's for starters.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Secondly, the unauthorized dissemination of classified material is a federal crime. If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
You think that's a Schwinn?
A clip there from Burn After Reading, and we'll start with this email from Samuel Todd Stevens at the University of Wisconsin. He writes, I just listened to your Burn After Reading review, and I couldn't disagree with you both more. I won't say I'm disappointed in you. I just feel sorry for you. It saddens me that your humor sensibilities could not mesh with the funniest film of 2008.
Wow.
It saddens me that Burn After Reading did not spread the joy to the two of you that the cast and crew clearly had making it. It saddens me that you were not laughing until you could no longer breathe at every scene with Brad Pitt, who's Chad Feldheimer, and Maddie, you just said, wow, get ready for another one.
Uh-huh.
Chad Feldheimer is the best Coen Brothers character since the immortal Walter Sobchak.
Wow, that sound you heard was Maddie's respect for Samuel Todd Stevens leaving the studio.
He goes on, I can only hope that someday you find yourselves on an airplane on a transatlantic flight, trapped 30,000 feet in the air, cornered in the middle seat with a curmudgeonly old man to your left and a creepily quiet insurance actuary to your right, and having read the Sky Mall magazine from cover to cover three times already, You desperately turn to the in-flight movie for entertainment, and that in-flight movie will be the Coen Brothers' comedic wonder, Burn After Reading. You will start laughing 5 minutes in, not stop laughing until the credits roll, spend the rest of the flight wondering how you could have ever doubted this inspired little spy spoof, and each of you will step off the plane a happier, more fulfilled person. Great podcast, guys.
Wow. If Samuel doesn't start writing PR for the big studios, we need to snatch him up to write PR for us. Because I'm sorry, that is so egregiously over the top. I can't even begin to disagree.
It's actually funnier than Burn After Reading, his email was. And, you know, I will say this. I'm not backtracking at all, but I probably was a little too harsh on Burn After Reading, especially at the end when I compared it to Intolerable Cruelty and said it makes that movie look like Annie Hall. Maybe I got a little too film critic-y there. This movie isn't awful by any means.
No.
I didn't mean to give that impression. I think we were both just unmoved by it. We just didn't like it all that
much.
You know,
you and I were both disappointed by Big Lebowski first time we saw
That's true.
Maybe Sam's right. Maybe it's going to take 5 or 6 viewings of this thing to finally get it.
We'll see.
Well, Sean from San Marcos, Texas, along the same lines, writes in, just heard your review of Burn After Reading. And I have to say, I haven't disagreed with y'all more until today. I do love y'all.
Yes.
I really wish I could use y'all in everyday conversation. I do really, I'm not making fun at all. I absolutely love that conjunction. However, I disagree without being able to refute anything you said.
Naturally.
I had a smile on my face throughout the entire movie and was laughing most of the time. It highlights what I always wonder when I listen to reviews. Do they go as a critic or as a movie goer? Burn After Reading was as funny as Lebowski. I laughed so hard during the Pitt Malkovich McDormand phone call. That was
Which is a funny scene.
That's a funny scene.
Very good.
And as enjoyable as Oh Brother, fine. That's neither here nor there for me. And as riveting at times as No Country.
Not quite.
Wow. I do agree that the scenes with J.K. Simmons kicked major ass. I completely agree. I mean, J.K. Simmons, he is on a roll.
He is.
Those scenes, every single line he delivers is pitch perfect.
Yeah, just like in Juno. You're right. He really is a great actor, and I'm glad he was put to good use here in this movie. We're going to close out the Burn After Reading feedback there because except for a few stray people who agreed with us, everyone really who wrote in loved this movie, and it does surprise me because I think it's minor Coen Brothers stuff. I do think there are some very funny bits in it, but on the whole, by the end of it, I was pretty bored. So we'll go ahead and close it out there and jump into the top 5 most anticipated fall movies feedback. This one from Johnny in San Francisco, California. Maddie is able to make room for Beverly Hills Chihuahua, which holds the distinction of being the only trailer that immediately made me want to bludgeon my eyes out with a fork, but neither one of you mentioned Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler. If Mickey Rourke's performance is nearly as good as I've been hearing, we're looking at potentially one of the great and improbable comebacks of all time. Johnny wants to know if The Wrestler was screened at Toronto, did I get a chance to see it, and what I thought of it.
Hey, Ram.
Hey there. How you doing, man?
Hey, Tommy. I'm going to be working tonight.
I know you, Tommy. I saw you out in Pennsylvania a couple months ago.
Allentown.
You're really good. You really brought it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Keep working, man. You know, people who drive the Cadillacs, ones with the politics, they run the show. It ain't about ability, so you're just hanging there.
We've heard the buzz about The Wrestler, but has it been picked up, and when is it going to be released?
I think supposedly it's going to play at the New York Film Festival in October is what I've heard, and then in December get rolled out, maybe not hit a lot of screens until January. Of course, it's Aronofsky. I'm intrigued by it. I want to see it. It did screen in Toronto, but not while I was there. I didn't get a chance to see it, so I can't weigh in on the movie. But a lot of people wrote in wanting to know where the love for The Wrestler was. It wouldn't have made your list anyway, though, Maddie, because of it being December. You stuck to just the fall,
exactly.
September and
October.
Exactly,
and it being Aronofsky. Well, Carrie from Oakland writes in, I may be
the only
one of your listeners to feel this way, but I cannot wait for Beverly Hills Chihuahua to be released. Adam, I am flying out to Oakland. I'm going to go see this movie with Carrie. My friends and I will be there on opening night, liquored up to be sure, but I've been dying to see this film ever since the first preview was shown on Defamer. It looks like sublime ridiculousness.
A lot of people didn't quite get where you were going last week with your number 5 pick of this movie. Maybe we should actually play a clip here. Let's hear the trailer for Beverly Hills Chihuahua so everyone knows what we're talking about.
My name is Bobby. I am descended from an ancient line of proud warriors. My ancestors went into battle alongside Aztec soldiers. Today, we move within the inner circles of the wealthiest and most powerful people on the planet. Who am I? The question is,
What am I? I'm a Chihuahua.
Chihuahua.
How can you not be dying to see that movie?
A, I am intrigued. B, I believe I did say I am always on the lookout for signs of the ruination of our society.
Right.
And I thought this film might offer that. But actually, you know, the plot, I sort of like the plot. I think it's kind of ingenious. It's sort of that alien in a foreign country. I like the commentary it's making on this sort of Paris Hilton culture living in Beverly Hills. I, for one, am looking forward to it. I don't think Disney really is going to play down that much. I think probably the trailer is playing up the more sort of hyper out there aspects
Maybe.
Of this film. I think the film is probably going to be pretty solid. Jamie Lee Curtis is in this film.
Pretty solid, probably pretty solid. I don't know if I would quite go that far, but we did also get this one from Jonas in Atlanta. Oh, Adam, why do you toy with my emotions so? First you choose The Soloist as your number 5 most anticipated film of the fall. Come on, man. Can't you recognize Oscar bait when you see it? Joe Wright, Oscar bait. Robert Downey Jr., I love him, but still, Oscar bait. And if that didn't tip you off, Jamie Foxx is a schizophrenic homeless musical prodigy.
Oh, man.
Didn't you learn anything from Robert Downey in Tropic Thunder? Never go full Juilliard. That might be one of the best lines of the year there from Jonas. I appreciate that. But yes, actually, if you heard what I said, Jonas, I did make the point as well that this movie was my across the universe memorial pick for most anticipated fall movie because it could be an absolute train wreck for all the reasons you mentioned. Jamie Foxx is a homeless schizophrenic musical prodigy. I'm actually not looking forward to that, but I'm giving Robert Downey Jr. and I'm giving Joe Wright the benefit of the doubt. But Jonas did come around. He says he's beginning to draft this email in his head on the ride home. He's still listening to the list, only to squeal with excitement at my number one pick, The Road. I figured if you chose The Soloist, no way would you pick something like The Road. However, I appreciate the pleasant surprise, and yes, I too love the novel, love Cormac McCarthy, and love the cast. However, what sells me on this film is director John Hillcoat. His film, The Proposition, bested my favorite Western of all time, Once Upon a Time in the West. Yes, I realize it is set in Australia and thus not technically a Western. However, its gritty and bleak presentation, which made many spaghetti Western look like Gene Autry Westerns, makes him perfect for The Road. He's absolutely right. Did you see The Proposition, Maddie, the John Hillcoat film?
I did not.
Guy Pearce. It was actually, I think, my number 10 film of that year, 2006, whenever it came out. Great performances, Ray Winston and also Emily Watson in that movie. It's very good, and I'll confess to Jonas that I forgot that John Hillcoat was the director of that movie. Yet another reason for me to anticipate The Road. I do agree that that film was so bleak, The Proposition, that he probably is the perfect guy to make a movie like The Road.
All right, well, let's close out here with Mike writing in from Buffalo, two of his choices from his top 5 most anticipated movies for this fall. Number 5, Quantum of Solace, continuing the gritty reinvention of James Bond with a perfect lead in Daniel Craig, the return of Jeffrey Wright and Judi Dench in terrific supporting roles, and the direction of the jack of mostly all trades, Mark Forster. Solace is my most anticipated action film in a long time. And his number one is, and I know you just saw the trailer for
yes.
this the other night, Frost Nixon. Seeing Frank Langella play Nixon reading the phone book would be worth the price of admission. Watching Langella combat Robert Frost in their climactic battle of wits and knowing the Tony Award-winning play is the basis for this Ron Howard-helmed film, a man, Adam, who knows how to craft grand films, though here looks like he's keeping it deceptively simple, makes Frost Nixon easily my most anticipated film of the season.
Well, I am looking forward to Quantum of Solace as well, even though it is the worst name action film of all time. I know I'm not saying anything new, but that's awful. On Frost Nixon, you're right. After we recorded our last show, actually, we went to a screening, and we saw the trailer for Frost Nixon before it, and I went, oh, wait, how did this not make my list?
You were as giddy as a schoolgirl.
I was. I absolutely am now intrigued as can be by that movie. It definitely would have snuck onto my list somewhere, honorable mention, or it definitely would have bumped out The Soloist. I can say that now. The trailer does look great, but here's my question for Mike and for you, Maddie. Is Frank Langella reading the script for Righteous Kill better than The Phone Book?
No, but it's better than Righteous Kill, probably.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe than it is right now. I think you probably could do it justice. Well, we appreciate all the feedback, as always. If you have any comments for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. Well, Will Ferrell, Nicole Kidman didn't work. Will Ferrell, Judi Dench Is that going to fly?
Nice.
Find out in our top five actor pairings we'd like to see. Stay with us.
A holy Bible and a book on punk rock grace your shows. Alongside Steinbeck, Salinger and Guthrie, and a compendium of modern poetry. And you're always a stone's throw away from the great beyond. At least you feel you are. For your son.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. And Maddie, coming out this Tuesday, not much that is new, at least in terms of recent releases, movies that maybe we've seen and reviewed here on the show, but a couple of classics are out. And I think I can refer to both of these films as classics. We start with The Godfather. This is actually the Coppola Restoration gift set. The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2, fully restored, including 5.1 stereo for the first time with direct involvement from Coppola.
Okay, I have to say, I love that the Godfather gift set does not include The Godfather Part 3.
Yes.
Coppola himself even recognizes at this point that that is not a gift to anyone.
Right, no, it is not. There are 5 discs in this set, including 2 special features discs with things like The Godfather World, The Masterpiece That Almost Wasn't, and more. Of course, for Godfather junkies like me, this is going to be right at the top of my Christmas list. And also on my Christmas list, you will find Grease, the Rockin' Rydell edition. It's got commentary by the director and choreographer, sing-alongs, and all sorts of other things. Maddie, did you grow up watching Grease like I did or not?
I really didn't. You know what I grew up watching?
Not Grease 2.
Grease 2?
Yeah.
I did. I really did.
Yeah, you're 2 years younger than me, even though you like to claim you're much younger than that, Maddie.
Wait, you're 27 years old?
Yeah.
I got to do the math here.
Exactly. But I know a lot of people just like you, a couple years younger than me, that group all grew up watching Grease 2, and I feel sorry for those people because it's such an awfully bad movie.
Michelle Pfeiffer,
I know.
Reproduction.
Oh, yeah.
Reproduction.
I'll always remember, and I don't know if I've told this story before or not, but I remember watching Grease 2 one day as a kid. I mean, it must have been 10 years old or something, seeing that scene, going to the grocery store with my mom, walking around the grocery store singing Reproduction out loud and not thinking anything of it.
You know you like it.
I know. And my mom finally stopping me and saying, Adam, really, you can't sing that song out loud in public. So I learned my lesson that day, unfortunately.
All right. Well, it's time now for donations. And we want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we are truly humbled by each and every donation. We really are. And it goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you to Silver Club donor Nick from Concord, California. Now, some places I know, like, you know, there's Concord, New Hampshire. Now, some people say Concord.
Right.
I don't know if it's Concord, California or Concord,
We've
California.
Actually had this spelled out for us before, I think by Nick, who has written in previously to the show. I actually had a chance to meet with Nick. He's a directing fellow at the American Film Institute. So an aspiring filmmaker, or I guess we can just call him a filmmaker.
And he listens to us?
Yeah, I know. We met up at the San Francisco meetup a while back. A good guy. And we do appreciate his donation, of course. And he can tell us how we should properly say his hometown.
We also want to thank Anthony. Oh, if I mangled Concord, listen, I'm going to absolutely destroy this one. Erlangen, Germany. Wow, I just sounded like a true Swede there. But thank you so much, Anthony Thomas from the city so nice. They had to name it twice, New York, New York. Terry from the city of lakes, beautiful Minneapolis, Minnesota. I want to send my love out to Marit and Tom Shepard. She is no longer Marit Robinson.
No,
I'm
she's not.
Having a hard time coming to grips with that, living in the uptown district of Minneapolis. Thank you, Terry. And the great Kamaria here in Chicago. She was instrumental in getting our Chicago meetup going. She's a great, great fan of the show. Thank you so much, Kamaria.
We should actually be giving we should actually be donating money to her, not the other way around.
Exactly. And do remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into the film spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name. You get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. You probably are entered to win a t-shirt or a mug at mm-hmm. the same time. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net, click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page. And also, we need to mention that, hey, you know, it's back to school time.
It is.
It's back to school time. All the cool kids are looking great. They're wearing their Abercrombie.
Sell it.
They're wearing their J. Crew. They're wearing their, I mean, JCPenney.
Yeah.
Whatever you got.
Yep.
If you don't want to look like the cool people, we've got the swag for you.
Yep.
You can go to filmspotting.net and you can buy a t-shirt. You can buy a mug. You can buy one of those cool bags.
Yes.
All the kids are wearing the bags.
You can buy the Film Spotting bag to go to college with.
Exactly.
Who wouldn't want that?
Who wouldn't want to go to college with Film Spotting?
That's absolutely true. Go to filmspottingmerch.com or filmspottingswag.com. We do appreciate all the support. Listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's top five time now on the show, and I wish you could see how giddy my co-host is sitting across from me right now as we're going to share with you the top five actor pairings we'd like to see. You mentioned it in the last segment. We are very director heavy on this show. I tend to get excited about films because of who is directing it, maybe even the screenwriter. The actors do come into play, but not necessarily as much as the director. You're much more of an actor guy, of course.
Directors are there to turn the lights on and make the actors look good.
Or the actors are actually just cattle. They're props. Move them around like Hitchcock did. That's fine with me, of course. No, I'm kidding. But you see the difference here in our perspectives, and you're going to see it even more as you get to hear Maddie's list. I have not heard it yet, but I have an idea of just how detailed and fun it's going to be. And so why don't you just jump right in? This was, of course, inspired by Righteous Kill. Unfortunately, a very bad movie, but we thought, hey, Pacino, De Niro, two acting legends acting together on screen. That inspired us to think of other pairings we'd like to see.
Right. And so this basically is a chance for me to give an ode to the people that I really love and respect in the industry. And of course, it's me. I can't just name a couple actors I'd like to see together. I actually have to come up with a pitch for the movie for them
so we can make this happen.
I knew it was coming. All right. So my number five, we'll start off a little bit slow. Louis Guzman and Jeffrey Wright. Louis Guzman, people would recognize him from Steven Soderbergh's films. Jeffrey Wright, distinguished actor, playing Colin Powell in Oliver Stone's upcoming W. I have the perfect project for them. We're going to revive Mammoth's American Buffalo.
Okay.
Guzman is going to play Donnie. Wright is going to play Teach. And then they're going to swap roles, and we're going to film both versions. This needs to happen soon.
I would die to see that, Maddie, I have to say. Very good. And I'll look for this, and I'll put a link in the show notes at filmspotting.net if I can find it. I remember reading very recently in Entertainment Weekly, they are reviving American Buffalo. Do you remember who the actors are? It was a total joke. I couldn't believe it.
Yes, I do, unfortunately, because you've heard me tell this idea to you for a long time. I've had this idea since 2002 with these actors. They are reviving American Buffalo with Cedric the Entertainer and John Leguizamo.
Wow.
I mean,
I thought it was worse than that, actually.
No,
I'm thinking of something else.
I mean, look, Leguizamo is a solid theatrical actor, but the fact of the matter is the comedy in American Buffalo is not slapstick. So, you know, it's not out there high comedy. And unfortunately, I'm really worried that Cedric the Entertainer, a guy whose stand-up comedy I absolutely adore, I don't know if he's going to quite have the gravitas. I'm assuming he's playing Donnie to pull it off.
Yeah, we'll have to see when that comes out. For my list, of course, not nearly as inspired as yours. I don't have great plot treatments in mind. I don't know where the story's going. I just thought of actors. Here's my one criterion, Maddie, and so I hope the list does live up to it. I had one very clear criterion, and that was simply it had to be a case where if I heard these two names We're in a film together. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter who directed it. Doesn't matter who wrote it. Doesn't matter what the story is. I would go see it just based on the fact that these two people were in the film.
Al Pacino, Robert De Niro.
Yes, exactly. It just happened this week. In fact, we discussed it, unfortunately. And my number five, this is the one that maybe my only real attempt at humor here, but it's definitely a genuine choice. And that pairing is Ed Norton and Val Kilmer. I'm calling it the director's nightmare because I do love both actors. I think they have some great roles between them. I think they are both brilliant performers, but they are also known as being two of the most temperamental, difficult people you'll ever find on a set. And I would just love to see that play out on screen. I'd love to hear about all the stuff behind the scenes and all the hellish things that went on that set. I think that'd be very interesting. Plus, Maddie, it would allow Val Kilmer, hopefully, to avoid roles like this one I found on his IMDb page today, The Steam Experiment. It's coming out with Eric Roberts and Armand Asante. Here's the synopsis. A former professor, Val Kilmer, concocts a brutal experiment in order to get the word out on the effects of global warming. He traps people in like a sauna or something in order to teach them about global warming.
No.
Armand Asante and Eric Roberts. That's Val Kilmer's project coming up.
You know, I do have to say, in Mr. Kilmer's defense, he is the only watchable thing in Oliver Stone's Alexander.
Yeah, and maybe the only watchable thing in The Doors. I'll say that.
Yeah, there
I don't
you
like
go.
That movie either.
Strong. Yeah. All right, well, my next pairing, here we go. Javier Bardem, everybody knows him from No Country for Old Men, and Paul Rudd, everybody knows him, of course, from Knocked Up and Forgetting Sarah Marshall. All right, here's my treatment. Here they go. They are the stars of a 1980s foreign cop / sarcastic tough cop television sitcom who leave the show at the acme of the show's popularity to pursue bigger endeavors. Now, Bardem, of course, the goofy Belky character on the sitcom, goes on to become one of the most respected actors of his day, garnering 5 Oscar nominations and 2 wins. Rudd flails about after some very misplaced endeavors. Think, you know, David Caruso in Jade, and hits his nadir when he defenestrates Vern Troyer in a VH1 reality has-been series. Now, it's still in development, but I think at this point, ABC, so hard up for programming options, they actually option another season of the original 1980s hit, and Rudd needs to convince Bardem to go along. I'm still fleshing it out, but I really, Rudd and Bardem, they are two of my favorite actors in very different genres. I seriously could watch them mow the lawn and be entertained. Adam, give me $8 million. I guarantee I can pull in 40 with this thing and a couple Golden Globes.
Well, I would be one of those people buying a ticket to see that pairing. I don't know about the story, but the pairing would bring me in, Maddie, to see those two guys.
I
love them,
about?
Too.
It's a commentary on, you know, late 20th century, you know,
now you know how to
pop
sell me.
Culture.
You
got
to get profound, and then I'll go to it. Okay. My number 4 here, and a lot of people probably saw this one coming because I have a man crush on, one James McAvoy, and he is paired with an actress, Marie-Josée Cross, who I loved so much last year in The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. You also may know her recently from Tell No One, Maddie, and she's in The Barbarian Invasions. She's 9 years older than McAvoy. Maybe you can have a little May-December romance going on, maybe a college student, college professor situation. I don't know. I just know that I like those actors a lot. I could see them together on screen, and I would go see any movie that they were together in. I won't go see any movie that they're in separately. Notice that I have not seen Wanted yet with James McAvoy, but I think those two together, I'd want to see that.
All right. Well, my number 3, it's my unnamed Jeff Bridges, William Hurt project. I think William Hurt, probably, he's going to play the golden boy newcomer on the political scene, and out of nowhere, he's a superstar running for president. The press practically anoints him, you know, for the job. Bridges is the reporter who, of course, uncovers something. Thrills
something.
Are going to ensue. We're going to get P.S. Hoffman involved. He's going to play Karl Rove. Probably my two personal favorite living actors, Jeff Bridges and William Hurt. I mean that sincerely. I am internally grateful for Bridges bringing me The Dude, bringing me Starman. Every single project he does, he plays it to the nines. And William Hurt, my God, bringing me Tom Grunick from Broadcast News. Let's go ahead and hear a clip.
Don't run off like everything's settled the minute you make up your mind.
He might be weird. He can talk more freely if I go alone. Why is that so hard to understand?
Not that it's hard. It's just that I'd like you to give me a minute so I can Catch up.
Unbelievable. You know, it's really sort of unfortunate. I was looking at his IMDb.com page, and they said that William Hurt at one point was considered to be the next Jimmy Cagney, the next big movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And they said his career had become a disappointment. And I really don't buy that for a second, because if you look at his body of work in the 80s and the supporting roles mm-hmm. that he's done throughout, the man knows what he wants to do.
He does.
Look, he's not Tom Hanks. I'll give you that. But the fact of the matter is the man is a very, very solid actor and will always have my respect.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm a big William Hurt fan and Jeff Bridges as well. You're 3 for 3 so far on your picks, Maddie. Nicely done. For my number 3 pairing, I've got Gael Garcia Bernal, of course, favorite actor of Michel Gondry. Alfonso Cuarón likes to use him as well. And this actor from Oliver Stone's World Trade Center.
You remember Starsky and Hutch? When I was a kid, it was on TV. And remember the theme song? When that would come on, I'd run around the house and arrest my sister Karen.
And that actor from World Trade Center is not Nick Cage. It is Michael Peña.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, exactly. A Chicago boy, Michael Peña, and he's very good in a movie that we're going to talk about next week on the show. That is The Lucky One. So I won't get into too much detail, but I did really like him in World Trade Center, which was probably his breakout role, his biggest role to date. I do think he's a very talented actor that can do just about anything. And of course, he's a Mexican-American. Garcia Bernal is a Mexican actor. I see maybe a buddy movie here. Maybe Garcia Bernal is like the character, the cousin who comes up from Mexico and has to learn the ways of the Americans or something. I really have nothing fleshed out there, Maddie, in case you couldn't tell.
Oh, that's an April release.
We'll sneak
that one out there.
Might even be a January release. It's that bad. But no, I think those two guys together, brilliant young actors.
Oh, they are terrific actors. All right, well, my number 2, Gene Hackman and Bobby Duvall. They are playing retired ex-CIA living in a retirement home in Bellingham, Washington. Now, these two actors actually did appear together in something called Geronimo, an American Legend, but anything that stars Jason Patrick I don't think really counts. So here's my pitch. When their prescription drugs become too cost prohibitive to afford, Hackman and Duvall enlist the help of the fellow retirement village neighbors to create the largest prescription smuggling ring across the Canadian border ever. Julie Christie will have to be involved, of course, as a love interest. These two actors, absolutely larger than life personalities. If you've never seen Duvall as the great Santini, you are missing out. And you've probably seen Gene Hackman as Norman Dale in Hoosiers, but I don't tire of mentioning that performance whenever possible. In fact, let's hear a clip.
No inside penetration, shut down those passing lanes. And you gotta play tough off those boards. Negate their height advantage.
Hickory, it's time to take the floor.
We're way past big speech time, hon. I want to thank you for the last few months. It's been very special for me.
Adam, I love you guys. I'm sorry. I might break down right now on the air. And when the preacher goes on to start his prayer by saying, "And David took from his satchel a rock." Oh, just send me home, Mama.
Nice.
Oh, it gets so dusty.
Wow, I would really like to see that movie. And I've got a perfect counterpairing to it. It didn't make my list, but an honorable mention. I've got sort of a sassy older version of Thelma and Louise with Julie Christie, who you mentioned, and Ellen Burstyn. Who wouldn't want to see that?
There we go.
I think it'd be great. One of my
honorable mentions. We'll get Beatty to direct.
I love it. My number 2, I have, of course, my favorite actress of all time, Naomi Watts, in this movie with Tony Leung, the great actor from movies like Infernal Affairs. He was brilliant in the subpar Ang Lee film Lust, Caution. Of course, the Wong Kar-wai movies. Really a brilliant actor. One of those guys I will see in anything. You put the two of them together, I can definitely see some kind of interesting love story happening with them. And the reason why is what I love about Tony Leung is that he's a very powerful actor, but he is very stoic. He's naturally one of those characters, I think, one of those actors who can hold his emotions in, whereas Naomi Watts is like a geyser of emotion. She can just let it go at any time. I think seeing that juxtaposition on screen would be really fascinating. So my number 2.
Great, great picks. Okay, Adam, I'm sorry. This one, it's
you're
gonna,
really proud of yourself, aren't you?
It is going to blow you out of the park, and it is going to set us up for years. If I can sell this thing, we are going to be set up for years. Prohibition era, Key West. Okay? Look, we just locked up the art direction Oscar for that year. Harrison Ford, out of a job, down on his luck. His wife, Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly pregnant. Harrison Ford has to become a rum runner, a reluctant rum runner to support his family. All the while, of course, this huge hurricane is just off the shores in the Gulf Coast. Now, we've got Ed Harris as the corrupt Treasury agent, but Pierce Brosnan, he's going to win the Oscar as the drunken best friend of Harrison who convinces him to break the law. Now, Harrison Ford, as Han Solo, is probably the reason I'm even doing this show. He kindled my interest in movies, so blame him, America, for my being here in this chair. And Meryl Streep she's just an alien talent. She really is an alien talent brought down here. 100 years from now, people will study Meryl Streep the same way we study Sarah Bernhardt, David Garrick, and Will Kemp today. I would love to see those two personalities on screen. Now, Harrison Ford is an unabashed, he will admit this, he is an unabashed movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And Meryl Streep, of course, is the actor's actress. We're going to see her in Doubt coming out later this year. But I really think that could be great. And if I can get Mr. Ford to take a pay cut for his shot at an Oscar, I think I can make this for about $18 million.
You think so?
And we'll put it out. Thanksgiving 2009?
Yeah.
We'll make about $65
million. I love it. I'm just worried that we have a lot of people in the industry who listen to this show. We have screenwriters all over Hollywood. Maddie, don't be surprised if it turns up in script form soon.
Patent pending.
Patent pending. Yeah. Good luck with that. You're trying to get the copyright on that. A brilliant idea. Great pick. I love both those actors. Really nicely done, Maddie. I have to give you some applause. Those picks were truly inspired, as expected. My list, again, probably not as inspired, but my number one, truly, again, two actors. If I saw these names on the marquee, there's no way I'm not plopping down my $10, and that is Leonardo DiCaprio with Chiwetel Ejiofor. I see them together, Maddie. I see them as detectives somehow. I don't know. You're not seeing it.
Detroit detectives.
Detroit detectives. Why not? DiCaprio can do anything as far as I'm concerned. I think Ejiofor is just one of the most natural talents we have on screen
right now.
He's so good, of course, in Mamet's film Red Belt, maybe the best thing about that film. In fact, he's definitely the best thing about that movie. I just think those guys are great at whatever they do. And with DiCaprio, you know, I had Body of Lies, the movie coming out with Russell Crowe, a great pairing there. It's coming out this year, the Ridley Scott movie. He's in that, and then I finally saw the trailer, and you have to hear him do a Southern accent. And I go, oh, no, that sounds awful. But I remember his accent sounded terrible in the trailers for Blood Diamond 2, and he's good in that movie, so I expect him to be good there. I expect him to be good in everything.
Okay, no, they're both great actors. DiCaprio is pretty amazing. In What's Eating Gilbert Grape, you need to see that film if you haven't. For his performance alone, Johnny Depp is terrific in that film as well. All right, so here, I got the premise for you.
Okay.
They're Detroit cops, right?
Yeah.
Tasked with going over to Windsor, Ontario, undercover, part of an illegal program to retrieve deserting American soldiers. I'm thinking Steve Zahn, probably going to play that guy.
I love it, Maddie. It works for me. Anytime you can fit Steve Zahn in, it's going to make any movie better. Maddie, did you have any honorable mentions, or did you get in the prime actor pairings?
Well, there? Sort of like David Mamet, I don't write well for women. So Zooey Deschanel and Samantha Morton didn't get roles, although I love both of them. And I also had a buddy comedy starring Michael O'Keefe and Michael Keaton that I would love to see.
Yeah, that would be good. Some names I toyed around with as well: Samantha Morton, Rebecca Hall, Javier Bardem on one of your lists, and of course Daniel Day-Lewis. And in that same high range as Daniel Day-Lewis, I had Sean Penn and Robert Downey Jr. I want the two ultimate serious actors, and I want them to be in a comedy. I mean an absolute slapstick comedy, Robert Downey Jr. and Sean Penn not taking themselves seriously at all. That would be my honorable mention.
You want a train wreck. Let's go Downey Jr., Russell Crowe,
yeah,
Sean Penn, and Javier Bardem.
Yeah,
there we
I like
go.
It.
That
yeah.
movie never gets made. The documentary about the making of that film wins an Oscar.
Without a doubt.
All right, well, those are our top five actor pairings we'd like to see. Send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Out new in wide release this weekend, Lakeview Terrace, the new movie from Neil LaBute, which we do recommend you see. Ghost Town, the Ricky Gervais film, which I had no interest in seeing. Don't think it looks all that funny. Every critic I've talked to says it's funny. They say go see it. So
You were tasked with going to see that this weekend. I want a 30-second review next week.
Well, the next film I'm going to mention, Igor, I actually did see last weekend with my kids, the new comedy there. It's an animated film, of course. I really don't know what to say about it. As I mentioned to you, anytime I take my kids to movies, it's an odd movie-going experience. They were kind of bored by it. The humor is very much geared towards adults, so I don't quite know what to make of Igor. And then My Best Friend's Girl, which, is that the movie that stars Dane Cook? Maddie, I think it does. So.
Is it him or Ryan Reynolds? Either way, I'm not interested.
No, exactly. The Duchess is opening on a few screens this weekend, and also the movie Towelhead is expanding, the new film from Alan Ball. On next week's show, Miracle at St. Anna, the new film from Spike Lee, we're going to review that. We're going to review The Lucky Ones and have an interview with the director of that movie, Neil Berger, and we will have our top five Spike Lee scenes.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his great, great production help. And to Scotland Yard Gospel Choir and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
For original coverage of this year's film festivals, check out blog.spout.com. Then discover more about the movies and join the conversation yourself at spout.com.
Well, like I said, it's such a mess down there afterward. I'll just grit my teeth a little bit and we'll figure it out.
It's not me. Friend of mine. Right? It's about 24 years. Jumper a few years ago.
Let's see.
Aren't you going to try and grab me?
Yeah. See, I wanted to do that. That's the best part.
Don't you try to catch me.
Okay.
All right.
Welcome us back, man.
Okay. Oh, man.
Oh, God.
This is going to be
unbelievable. I'm dreading this.
I cannot.
I'm dreading.
My mind. Sometimes it surprises even me.
The magic. The gold is right there.
This is where the magic is, right here. My number five, you know, it's pretty straightforward. So, but okay. then we get golden. Now it doesn't sound like I'm trying to hold my voice back.